Hi, food fans. Alton Brown here. This is the Alton Brown cast, and we've got a doozy of a show for you. I don't think I've actually used doozy to describe a show, but we certainly have one today. As always, we're going to deal with some questions coming in from you guys, either via email or Twitter or, you know, what other Webernetter ways you got going there. And then we're going to have a little exploration of one of my favorite beverages. It's called bourbon whiskey. And we're going to be interviewing or having a chat with a gentleman that's in a very unique position in the bourbon world. His name is Julian Van Winkle, and he makes a bourbon called Pappy Van Winkle, and we're going to be talking with him about that. And then we'll have some a little fun kind of taste testing at the end that actually won't involve any Pappy Van Winkle because I couldn't actually get any. I'm like 400 on the list. Anyway, stick around for the show. First, we're going to deal with your questions. All right, I'd like to answer some call-in questions. Here we are on the line. This is the Alton Brown cast. Hi, Jackie, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, it's Alton. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm great. You sound like you're in the next country. It's fantastic.
I'm in Ohio, so yeah, pretty
well,
much.
Well, that kind of is. It's almost like another country. It's a very pleasant country, though. I like Ohio. So what's going on with you today? Can I answer or deal with some complex culinary conundrum, perhaps?
Not a hugely complex conundrum, but as far as when you're making the Bavarian pretzels with the lye solution, what would you recommend to do to help protect your baking sheets? And then how would you recommend disposing of the lye solution safely without, you know, dissolving your plumbing pipes through your sink?
Those are very, very good questions. You know, for those of you that are listening that don't understand why Jackie is willing to brave chemical burns, is that there's no real way to brown the outside of a pretzel properly without pre-gelatinizing basically the starches on the outside of it and treating it with a very, very, very high pH solution. Now, when we did this on Good Eats a few years ago, we decided that we had to stay with something that was relatively consumer-friendly and that wouldn't require, you know, everybody signing waivers. So we went with a solution that was just heavily, heavily infused with baking soda to try to get that pH up or to get a base, alkaline solution. However, in the real world, when you're making serious pretzels, there's only one solution that's readily available that will give you the pH level that you really need, and that is caustic lye or food grade lye. The problem, of course, with food grade lye is you'll put your eye out. Anybody that's seen the movie Fight Club knows it can be some pretty nasty stuff, and it's extraordinarily caustic, and it can eat right through your hand. So your questions are just. Here's how I deal with it, because I do use food grade lye in my own kitchen. I have found that if you're working on aluminum sheets, as long as you're using parchment paper, kind of industrial grade parchment paper that is impregnated with silicone, that's pretty good at kind of maintaining, a good protective layer, against that lye. I've also been told that some people will literally kind of grease up their pans, and that will protect. As far as, protecting, dealing with getting rid of it, most people simply cut it with an acid. Depending on the brand that you're using and the concentration, the strength of that lye solution, you can neutralize it with vinegar.
Okay.
And basically render it harmless, or at least harmless enough to get rid of it.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, sure thing. Thanks very much for calling. And next up on the Alton Brown cast, where we're all squandering some time, is Justin. Justin, are you with me?
Yes. Hi, Alton.
Hey, Justin, where are you?
I'm actually in Parkersburg, West Virginia.
Do you have a question for me, sir?
Yes, thanks. I wanted to know your opinion on braising and what the best method is for specifically like a top blade steak. I do not have a pressure cooker, but I have slow cooked. Are there any advantages to pressure cooking versus slow cooking?
Okay. That's a very, very good question. There are advantages, but there are also disadvantages. Keep in mind that regardless of whether you're using a pressure cooker or we'll just call it a slow cooker, not saying any particular tool, but there's going very low and very slow for a long period of time with a piece of meat, or there's using pressure to raise the boiling point, therefore breaking down connective tissue very, very quickly. Either way, you can still overcook The meat. And in most cases, now the blade steak that you're talking about, that's a chunk from the chuck subprimal. There's a fair amount of connective tissue in there. It's not the cut that I prefer for a pot roast. I like a cross cut, more like a seven bone cross cut is just better for me. But there's enough connective tissue there where we need to break that down. Do you know what the difference is between braising and stewing?
Not exactly,
okay.
No.
Braising uses a very small amount of liquid. Stewing is more like a soup, and you use a lot of liquid. So, for instance, if we were going to cut that steak of yours up into chunks and cook it in such a way that it was pretty much submerged in a liquid, that would be stewing, okay? When we talk about braising, we're generally talking about a larger piece of meat, and we're talking about a small amount of liquid. Well, that's kind of hard to pull off in a crock pot because you can't submerge it. You know, you can't get it in there in such a way to do that. So I actually find that the most efficient tool for slow cooking a piece of meat like that and braising it is wrapping the thing up in a good bit of heavy-duty aluminum foil. What that lets me do is it lets me add some liquid. It lets me add some other flavoring agents and kind of make a vessel that fits it so perfectly that I get good contact with the liquid all the way around without having to do something like a sous vide where we're literally sealing something in a bag, which is kind of the ultimate form of braising, I guess. So I would take that seven bone. Sorry, I would take that that blade steak you're talking about. I would rub it down with, you know, whatever herbs and spices you want. Then I would add a very small amount of a flavorful liquid. Now, what I do in a lot of cases is I'll take combine a fruit juice, some wine, maybe a little vinegar for acidity, and I'll literally cook it down until it's concentrated, because as soon as meat juices start coming out into that liquid, it's going to dilute it. So I tend to make a very flavorful liquid base with some other things in it, like, you know, capers, spices, whatever. And I make myself kind of an envelope with a heavy duty foil with a little open end so that I can just pour that liquid in on top of that meat and then seal it up. And then I would stash that in the oven at, you know, 250 degrees for like 8 hours. And to my mind, that does just as good a job as a pressure cooker and sometimes better. But here's the thing, that steak, that roast, whatever it is that you're going to be slow cooking, is always going to be better the next day. Because what happens is that the gelatin that's become collagen, it's called resolubilization. It can actually kind of move back into the meat, migrate back into the meat, and become part of the meat tissue again, which is why pot roast is always better on the second day. Although I do like the pressure cooker, and if I was going to make a pot of chili, I would do a pressure cooker. If I was going to make, I like oxtail soup. I like shanks. I like beef shanks, things with huge amount of connective tissue that I do in the pressure cooker. But for a kind of piece of meat like you're talking about, I would do the envelope method with foil.
That method sounds awesome. I'm really excited to get in the kitchen and try it.
Enjoy, Justin. Cooking's a good thing to do. Mike, are you there?
I am.
Hey, it's Alton Brown. How you doing?
Oh, I'm great. I've been seeing a lot of footage or a lot of pictures on Facebook and Twitter about different things that you've been different shots with you and the camera. Is that a web episodes or what is that?
Well, I might as well just go ahead and tell you. That is for my new YouTube channel. That's all I'm going to say. I'm not going to tell you when that will start, but yes, I am going to have a YouTube channel that is going to be all mostly shorts, things in the 3 to 5 minute range.
Well, that's fantastic.
Well, I think so. I wouldn't be doing it.
No, it is
the kind, I promise you this, if you're a Good Eats fan, you will like it. All right, I got to move on, buddy. Thanks a lot for the call. All right, Alton Brown here on the Alton Brown Cast. Going to take a few questions from the internet. Our Ask Alton at AltonBrown.com email box is running over.
This first one comes from somebody I feel kind of bad for, Rebecca Rogers, who's apparently a Southerner. Exiled in California. She got in touch via Gmail. She says, I keep trying biscuits from cookbooks. Following the recipe carefully and not overmixing, half of them spread, flop, and turn into an amorphous mass during cooking. They also seem strangely chewy. Where am I going wrong, and how do I get biscuits with integrity like the ones grandma made back in the day? All right, well, there's a few kind of telltale signs here if we're going to try to, you know, house this recipe. That's what I call it when you guys remember House. Okay, yeah, it's a good show. Guy with a cane. Doesn't matter. Anyway, Okay, so you've tried multiple recipes, Rebecca. You say that you have followed the recipe carefully and that you have not overmixed, but half of them spread, flop, and turn into amorphous master in cooking. My big question, and what, of course, you've left out here is what happened to the other half? Because if the other half are successful, then what you want to do is to find some way to do that to the half that's bad. So I'm going to assume, I'm going to give you the benefit of a doubt, that you are indeed following the recipes correctly and that your method is sound and that you are not overmixing. So we're going to turn to your ingredients. You're exiled in California, which leads me to believe you might be using a flour of non-biscuit-friendly nature. Typically, what you want for a biscuit is a red winter wheat flour, which is what is typical in the South, finely milled. You may be using some kind of, you know, crunchy granola, tree-hugging California nuts and berries kind of flour there that might be, number one, might have some kind of whole grain business going on in it, which could throw things off, and also might be higher in protein, which would definitely answer for that the strangely chewy part, because, of course, the higher in protein you go, the more potential for gluten you've got being formed in the dough, regardless of how much you are you're mixing it. So that's the first thing, is we need to get hold of a good, if not a southern flour, then at least kind of an East Coast all-purpose one. I would suggest like a straight-up King Arthur flour or maybe a white lily, even though white lily technically isn't really a southern flower anymore. Anyway, all right, so let's say that you're going to first off take care of that. All right, let's look at your methodology. You use some interesting terms here. You say that they spread, flop. I don't understand flop. I mean, I think of flopping as something that, like a souffle, you know, it gets really tall and then it flops over. So those two words don't really go together. However, turning into an amorphous mass and spreading, that makes sense to me. And what that speaks of is one, too much moisture, perhaps, or more specifically, two, the wrong pan. I make biscuits that are quite moist. That was something that was taught to me, not by my beloved grandmother, but by Shirley Coyer, who I wish was my grandmother. Because, you know, you can always use more grandmothers. But if she taught me anything, it's that you want a lot of what we call oven spring, which is you want a lot of steam conversion in your biscuit to lift it. But that requires a pan that can kind of guide it. Now, I make my biscuits in a 2-inch deep round spun aluminum pan. So, and I put them in there pretty tight so that they've got nowhere to go but up. It sounds like you might be making a relatively wet dough, but you're putting it on like a sheet pan or a cookie sheet or something that is allowing them to expand in the wrong direction, which would, you know, explain both the spreading and the amorphous massing. The flopping, I don't know. Maybe they're flopping on the table. Maybe that's more like a critical review. You know, these biscuits are a complete flop. I don't know. That one confuses me. The other thing that I'm a little bit suspicious about is your oven. Oven temperature, you know, ovens lie. They do. It's just their nature. They lied to us. You really do want biscuits to go into what we call a rising oven, an oven that is actually cycling on. Cycle, you know, ovens cycle on and off. That's just it's what they do. It's part of the line. So since we don't really know how accurate your oven is, you might want to have it checked. You might want to at least put an oven thermometer in there and check it out and see if it's doing what it's even close to what it says it's doing. But the other thing would be to actually turn your oven up to its final temperature about 5 minutes before you put the biscuits in. You want to make sure that that oven is actually heating. Even if it's not all the way to that heat yet, as long as it is actively heating, you're going to get a little bit more of a rise out of it, you know, unless it's down like at 100 degrees. So I would say set it for 50 degrees under its target temperature, then turn it up about, let's say, 2 minutes before you put in those biscuits. Put them into a pan with straight sides and try to find yourself some good southern flour. Here's somebody, a guy named Mike, is asking me about kitchen torches for creme brulee. I got to tell you, I don't mess around with torches. If you're going to torch something, torch something. I like a company out of Kansas called Red Dragon, and I think they may be in the process of changing their name to like Green Dragon. I don't know, but if you Google, actually let's do it right now because I'd heard that they were changing their name. Hold on, Red Dragon torch. They make these great torches that are used to burn weeds around chain link fences. Okay, Red Dragon torch. Of course, it's available at Amazon.com. No, they don't tell me pay me to say that. But here you go. You got the Red Dragon VT2 kit that'll deliver your basic 400,000 BTUs. that should take care of your creme brulee. I use it for a very large format brulee, like a really big baked Alaskas, and you can also use it to like cook whole fish. So look up Red Dragon online and get yourself a Red Dragon torch because they're pretty awesome. A lot of fun. Scares the dogs when I break that thing out. All right, here's one question from Twitter, and then I promise I'll get offline. This comes from The Residential Chef, which is apparently a young lady named Tiffany. He says, does it matter what type of surface you roll dough on, wood versus granite? Most doughs, Tiffany, can be rolled on wood just fine, especially lean doughs like say a baguette or even biscuits can be rolled on wood, even though they've got solid bits of fat in them, or doughs that have a fair amount of oil. But there's a point to where there gets to be so much fat inside a dough that keeping it cold really is a profit. That would certainly be true of laminated doughs like a puff pastry. Would certainly working on a colder surface would be better for that. A papresse is another type of course, a French dough that's used for a lot of tarts, has a lot of sugar in it, typically about a cup. A couple of sticks worth per 2.5 cups of all-purpose flour. So the more solid fat you end up having inside a dough, and this would certainly be true of pie doughs as well, then a colder surface is going to give you more time to work with that dough. So just something to keep in mind. And by the way, it doesn't have to be granite or marble. It can be a cold piece of metal, really almost anything. But by and large, if you work fast, there's not much you can't do on a good wooden cutting board. So Alton Brown here. It's the Alton Brown Cast. I'm in the office of Julian Van Winkle, and Mr. Van Winkle's on the phone, obviously telling somebody who's calling to try to find his whiskey, telling them that basically, you know, they can't have it, which is kind of funny to listen to. I'm going to ask him how many phone calls like that do you get a day? Julian, what do you say? Eight? And it's usually somebody who just calls up and wants to know where they can get it.
When's it coming out? Where's it going to be sold? And how can I get a bottle? And my son's dying of cancer. We get that stuff. We got Marines over there in Afghanistan. Got to help him out. He's coming over. So,
And do any of those stories ever work?
No, we have no sympathy for anybody. It's all even. Everybody's on the same plane.
Everybody's on the same planet. Everybody's got the same complaints.
I'm sorry they're sick or overseas, but get in line.
Sometimes the line doesn't really help very much.
No, it doesn't. I mean,
I was lucky. I had a banner year last year. I got two bottles last year. I gave a lot of it away. One of them was a gift, and one of them I found at a package store in the West Village in New York. Guy that owned the store is a real big fan of mine and had one bottle under the counter. It was the Lot B. It was the 12. Hmm. But currently, with the waiting list I'm on now, I'm expecting to get my next bottle when I'm 63. So I've got that to look forward to. And I didn't think that I would live past 60. I always said I probably wouldn't, and now I've actually got something to look forward to.
I'm on the
lowest I'm on a list is 400. That's the lowest that I'm on. I'm on lists from Los Angeles to Georgia, where it's not impossible. New York, all plants place 412, I think. The lowest I am on a list. So, the way I look at it is I know a lot of people who are, rich and famous and frequently have bottles. And so I just travel with an empty flask. And when they're not looking, I go into the cabinet and I steal some.
There you go.
And that's, fine. That's fine by me. I want to start by saying that the first bourbon that I had in adulthood, I had a stepfather who passed away many years ago, but he was a really big influence on me. He didn't marry my mom till I was in college. And he was he's from Louisiana. He was from a logging family. And he was a bourbon man. And he drank all different kinds of bourbon. And the day that I finally said that I wanted to have some, he went and he got this container out of the bar. It was the ugliest thing. It was ugly. I mean, it was not an attractive container. It reminded me of something that somebody would have put cologne in the 70s, and it was Rip Van Winkle.
Really?
In this canister kind of thing.
He had decanted it in something.
No. It was like the package that it had come in. It was this ceramic
thing.
My father's rolling over in his grave. He probably designed that.
I know. That I'm saying
probably it looked somewhere.
It looked shockingly like the one.
It was a St. Patrick's on the top. Day decanter.
It was one of these St. Patrick's Day decanters, and he said, "Don't look at the." He said, "Don't look at the container," because I was, you know, I fancied myself as a cultural person of this time, and I thought that, you know, this stuff was going to come out of this great bottle. But I have to tell you that the whiskey that was inside, he said, "Just shut up and drink this." And I remember him putting it in a glass, and I was like, "Do I get some ice or anything?" And he's like, "No." And we drank it. So your dad or your granddad's bourbon was the first bourbon that I ever had.
Oh, good. I wonder what year that was.
I don't know. I didn't. This well, I can tell you the year that I had it. Mm-hmm. The year that I had it was 1984. And I had not drunk bourbon up to that point, mm-hmm. but I don't know how old it was when I got
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
he had been hoarding this stuff for God only knows how long.
Mm, I bet that was good.
He was one of those guys that like he bought in mass when he found something he liked, mm-hmm. you know, and he bought by the case kind of guy, no matter what. Anyway, I just wanted to throw
that's the only
out.
Way you could sell bourbon back then, or one of the ways is put it in some fancy bottle, like either a duck hunter or a coal miner or a fireman or a St. Patrick's Day decanter, and that's a good way to sell whiskey. I mean, that's kept us in business for quite a while. Then the market hit $50 retail, and boop, that was the end of that.
That was the end of that? Mm-hmm. Do you actually remember when you came to the realization, oh, my God, we don't have to put our whiskey in these ugly bottles anymore?
Well, it was pretty much, it was thankfully, because I was stuck with a lot of them, so that's pretty much when the realization came, and the bank would call every 3 months and say, your interest is due on your loan. So that's when I said, I'm going to think I'll just start selling whiskey instead of decanters.
When did you know that you were going to be in the whiskey business?
When my father asked me to work for him, about 1977, I said, sure, that'd be fine. And he was a tough guy to work for, and I knew that. But anyway, I figured I would like this business because it had quite a romance to it, seeing, you know, what he had done in the past with his other brands.
What did, when you look at the kind of work that he did up to that time and the kind of work that you've done since, is it even the same business?
Not really. It's a whiskey. You're a whiskey salesman, and he tried to selling decanters or selling the actual whiskey. You know, we had the old Rip Van Winkle brand in a bottle at that point, mm-hmm. and that was selling a few hundred cases a year, 200 or 300. That was about it, just because he was just starting to get the brand going. But as I mentioned, the decanters were a way to get a guy's attention down the road who doesn't care about maybe drinking some whiskey. A lot of these people buy the bottles and never open them. That was the deal. They didn't care about the whiskey.
They were decorative.
Yeah,
it was a decorative item,
right?
That happened to have some in it,
right? Or they were a firefighter, so they wanted all the firefighter editions. You know, we'd make eight of them, eight coal miners, eight firefighters. We did a lot of school bottles. You know, Georgia.
Because school and liquor go so well together.
Exactly. We actually had to get the blessing of the school. You know, the people that would license the agreements for us, we'd had to get permission from the colleges to do this, obviously, because you're using their trademark.
Sure.
And they said, sure, that's fine. And we give some money to their alumni association. And it was also a good mix. We made them for, you know, Kentucky and Georgia and LSU and Princeton and all kind of different schools all over the country. So that was fun doing that. You know, making the going down there and showing them this nice Bulldog bottle in Athens and meeting Vince Dooley. That was pretty cool.
He's probably still got one.
I bet he does. I bet he does.
Some of his cabinet someplace. So by the time you took over the business and your dad got sick and died.
Right.
And it happened pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Were you ready to take over the company by the time that happened?
No, I joined him in 77 and he died in 81.
81. It's a fast turnaround.
I didn't have no clue what I was doing, basically. So the debt kept mounting, and the amount of decanters in the warehouse kept mounting.
So you decided not to give up, but only because you didn't really know what else to do. Nothing else seemed any more appealing.
Yep, I was just going to fight this thing through, and you know, just when the money ran out, I guess somebody would say, "That's it, time to go home.
We're going to have the keys now."
Right.
Exactly. How old were your daughters at this point? I'm trying to get the picture of kind of what your family pressure was like. And,
yeah, they and were they were born in 79.
Okay, and three triplet identical
right.
triplets.
Right.
Son you don't born. Call them twins anymore, son.
Yeah, there were three twins.
Three twins.
You can describe them as three twins. Preston, my son, was born in 77.
So here you are with a business that's mostly in decanters, four kids, all under the age of two.
Mm-hmm.
You're I'm not going to say that's desperate, but that's not exactly rosy.
It wasn't a great situation. It was stressful. It was pretty stressful.
So you keep doing this, and then something changed. Something had to change. There must have been a day or a month or a week where something, where the balances started to tilt. Something happened.
Yeah, and it was, I mean, I had a lot of help from different people along the way as far as designing labels and what shows to go to and what bottle to use and, you know, just little pieces of friendly advice from friends. And some people were in the business, some people weren't. You know, the Pappy label was just an idea. I saw that picture right there of my grandfather. I found in a file, and I said, I'm going to make a label out of that and honor him with a 20-year-old bourbon because I had excess bourbon sitting around. I mean, I'd bought barrels, and I had excess bourbon sitting around, too, that I had to sell. So I came up with a 20-year-old label because I had excess whiskey. That's where that came from.
And it was already 20 at that point?
Yeah. I didn't sell it at 12 or 18 or whatever. It was older. I didn't have a lot of it, but once the 20-year-old brand took off, then I started buying, you know, younger whiskeys and some older whiskeys also. But our Chicago distributor entered the 20-year-old in the Beverage Tasting Institute, their ratings, and it got a 99.
Yeah, so that's the big show. And that was in what year was that?
Probably early 90s, 94, 5, yeah. 6, something like that. And Wine Enthusiast published the results. So Pappy Van Winkle, highest whiskey ever rated, not just bourbon, but whiskey. So that's when the phone started ringing.
And did you see that coming?
No. I didn't even know they put it in there.
When you found out, I mean, was you like, what are you talking about? That's just this stuff from these barrels over here. Or did you know? You've been drinking this stuff all your life. Did you know how special it was?
Yeah, that was different. I mean, it was different than anything I'd ever had. And probably a lot of people didn't like 20-year-old bourbon, but it was something that I, you know, was familiar with all my life, or, you know, as an adult drinking older whiskey. So I said, this is special. So I'm glad somebody else likes it. So that's kind of what got my attention. And then it got to be very popular, and distributors started ordering it. And so that was kind of the start of us putting us on the map as far as this little brand that we were selling, you know, a few hundred cases a year of.
And now you're up to how many cases?
6,000 or 7,000.
Which is a minute amount of whiskey compared to a Jim Beam.
Right.
Or most houses.
7 million or whatever. Yeah.
Probably 5 to 7, I bet, worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
And you just won't do that?
No.
How
no.
Come?
Because
one of the things that makes me most interested in you is it's you and I have some in common. We have small businesses and refuse to up output. Right. I won't do it because I'm a control freak, and I just refuse to have any part of what I do handed over to other people in order to make more of it. That's my own sickness. Mm-hmm. What's yours?
Probably a little bit of the same. Just I've seen what happens to brands that get too big. I could name a few here, but I'm not. But they get too big and the quality goes downhill. I'm worried about that because what we're most interested in, as my grandfather said, wherever that great quote is, we're about making fine bourbon a profit.
We make it a profit
if we can, always find bourbon.
And you believe that. You've drunk your own Kool-Aid, so
to speak. Yeah. So that's the only way I'm going to go with it. We may get up to 15 or 20,000 cases down the road when, you know, the supply catches up with the demand, but it'd never be much bigger than that in my lifetime, I don't think.
Let's pretend I've never had your whiskey. Is it really that good?
I like it. Doesn't mean you will.
But you like it. You make a product you like.
Yeah. That's why I enjoy selling it, because I like it.
Let's talk about you're not down at the distillery every day. You're not down there shoveling corn out of trucks. Mm-hmm. You're not skimming, you know, mash. You're not checking column stills. So what you really do is you take a distillate that is made to a specific recipe, mm-hmm. right? And you oversee it, its growth as a liquid. It comes out of a still, it goes into barrels. You manage the aging of those barrels, the blending of the liquids inside those barrels, and then sorting out what gets to go in a bottle and what doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
So you're really a judge in a way.
But we have it's our formula we're using, my grandfather's formula, which we've used
his actual mash bill.
Almost 125 years. Yes.
The recipe.
Right. So we know that's what we're going to taste someday. And, then we age it and bottle it accordingly to, depending on, you know, what age it's going to be in the bottle.
You'd still taste all of it.
Not around to taste every barrel, but either Preston or myself do.
So one, Van Winkle is tasting that whiskey.
90% of it, probably. There may be some situation where we're unavailable and they've got to taste these barrels to put the bottle, you know, because they have a bottling next week. And they'll, Buffalo Trace people will, you know, taste them because they have a panel that tastes all the whiskeys also.
But a panel doesn't have your mouth.
Right, but they pretty much know what our flavor profile is after 11, 12 years of this.
Do you ever wonder if your tastes are changing because you're getting older? The chemical sensing apparatus are changing.
Could be, for sure. But I can still taste something I don't like.
Hmm.
And
is that a big part of this? It's not just tasting what you like. It's being able to immediately tell what you don't.
What I don't like. That's what sends off a red flag for us.
What don't you like?
Young, we call it green whiskey. It's like, if you taste that White Dog there, it's very corny. It's very young. Sometimes the barrels don't age properly because they may have too much sapwood in the staves. Which
White Dog, by the way, is the distillate straight out of the still
before
it's been aged. Right. We call that White Dog.
It's okay. Clear. It may, because of the way the barrel's made and what wood's in the barrel, it may not age properly. So we throw that out. Something too hot, maybe it's been stored on a top floor or something, or for some reason the barrel has given the whiskey maybe too much char or something, too woody. So it's a few red flags that go off that we try and throw out, and we just won't bottle those.
Or the change in kind of the whiskey industry over the last 20 years, the fact that we've got so many more brands, has this led to more sophisticated drinkers, do you think? The people that are your customers, have they literally learned how to taste bourbon in a way that maybe people just didn't do to 15, 20 years ago even?
It's amazing the sophistication that the general bourbon public has as far as, these bourbon nerds out there, which I've seen, I'm sure you've seen these websites with these people on there. They can taste, you know, different flavors and specific, like even our different ages, they'll, you know, show up, they'll describe different flavors and so forth. So I'm amazed at the you know, how sophisticated their palate is a lot of times.
That your descriptive powers are in line with that, or do you just taste it and like it or not like
it?
Yeah,
I'm a like it or don't like it guy.
You said that because you don't exactly have to spend a whole lot of time out selling your whiskey anymore, when's the last time you had to actively sell your wares?
Gosh, I can't remember.
Well, congratulations. Yeah. You've done a fine job. But
it's all blends together. But, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, for sure.
But now that you're not actually having to do anything but drink whiskey and throw away a bunch of it and say what's good and what's bad, you're spending a lot of time. But now you've got more notoriety than you've ever had before.
Yeah.
So you're having to talk to folks.
Right.
But you're not trying to sell whiskey. So what do you talk about?
Well, we actually do. We go to 2 or 3 whiskey shows a year. The Whiskey Fest shows. Mm-hmm. They're in New York and Chicago and San Francisco.
And what do you talk about when you go to these?
We just simply, you know, they've come in and they want to try it. And we just talk, you know, some people have never heard of it, which is, you know, there are plenty of people never heard of it out there. So
we Scotch drinkers.
Yeah, a lot of them are, because there are a lot of Scotches in the room. You can smell them coming because they've been to the Laphroaig table or
they've
something.
Yeah, they smell like ashtrays because they've been on the Laphroaig table.
But we, you know, it's fun to go to those shows and still, you know, just be a part of the business still. We don't want to disappear by any means, but it's fun to go to those and still turn people onto the whiskey and just see how much they enjoy it, because they, for years and years, and they still do it. You know, they come up to the table and say, "Oh, it's the best in the room," and, you know, it gives you a nice feeling. It's good. There are other people that like it also.
But if you're teaching seminars, if you are actively educating now, are you? You're a ambassador for the art form, we'll say. Mm-hmm. What kind of stuff are you teaching people? What is it you want people to know?
Pretty much how bourbon's made, what bourbon is. Our family history, because there are not a whole lot of family businesses around, especially in the bourbon business, where it's just strictly family.
Well, can you give us
the name on it?
Can you give us the quick rundown on the family history?
Well,
because I guarantee you, at least half the people that are listening to this don't know.
Yeah, sure. It's my grandfather, who grew up in Danville, Kentucky, got out of Center College and started working for a wholesaler in Louisville, liquor wholesaler called W.L. Weller, 1893. And gradually he worked his way up the business ladder, and the Stitzel Distillery was making whiskey for themselves, and also they contract for W.L. Weller and Sons, so they made their brand. And the two companies merged before Prohibition to form Stitzel Weller, and they were one of the few five or six distilleries that were allowed to make whiskey during Prohibition, medicinal whiskey, where you had to get a prescription from your doctor and go to the drugstore, and every 10 days or whatever, you could get a pint of whiskey. And that was the law until December 1933, when Prohibition quit, and it was one of the amendments that undid another amendment. So it was the first one that did that. But Pappy started his own distillery in Derby Day 1935 here in Louisville, called the modern day Stitzel Weller. And they made Old Fitzgerald, Rebel Yell, Cabin Still, and W.L. Weller were the four brands. So my dad joined Pappy after the war, and my uncle were also worked in the factory, this fellow right there, King McClure. And
up on this picture here, mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I see the Old Fitzgerald
right
kind of tin on the table there.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's your grandfather in the middle,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. And operated the but Pappy passed away in 1965, and Dad continued the distillery operation until 1972, when he was forced by some stockholders to sell the brand. He didn't want to, but he was forced to. The bourbon business was not great then, so. He was sick. I mean, it almost killed him. It really did. It was rough. So that's when he started this little label, Old Rip Van Winkle, which is the only thing he took with him as far as a label from the sale.
So he actually got that out of the raid, so to speak.
They said you can have the old Rip Van Winkle label, which was an old pre-prohibition label that he bought years ago. So got some whiskey that he had made at Stitzel Weller, bought it back from himself, I guess you'd call it, and started the brand. So a lot of people, when they start in the bourbon business, they start making whiskey, and you can't sell it for 4, 5, 6 years. But he was able to buy some aged whiskey that he had made to start up the business immediately and put in the old Rip Van Winkle brand and some of these decanters that he made also. And he passed away in 81. I joined him in 77, so he was just around for... I worked with him for about 4 years before he passed away, and then I kept the business going, struggling for many, many years. I mean, I guess you can say I struggled from 1977 until, 2000 roughly was when things started to take off, or change. As far as finally get a paycheck, that was nice to get a paycheck. I never used to get one.
And now your son.
Right. He joined me right out of college, went to UK, and I grabbed him the day after college because in 1983, our old distillery, Stitzel Weller, was doing the bottling for us. And mm-hmm. When Dad died, they asked me to take a hike because they really weren't making any money on that bottling. So I had to find my own bottling facility.
Do you ever remind those people about that now when you see them, just to kind
of
point out?
Most of them are gone, so I can't do that anymore.
I'm sorry. Because that would be really great to gloat over that now.
Exactly.
I think.
No, they were a big company, and they could care less about me, really. So I bought this little bottling plant in Lawrenceburg in 1983, and that kept me going until we hooked up with Buffalo Trace in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And they had W.L. Weller, our old brand. They bought that in 1999. So
that belongs to Buffalo Trace now?
Yes.
They actually own that brand?
Yeah, they bought it from Diageo, who owned some of our old labels also.
Some of the old labels.
Yep, but they bought Weller, and same formula as our whiskey, so it was a natural... for us to kind of get back together again. The Buffalo mm-hmm. Trace people wanted to kind of bring a Van Winkle back. And at first, when I was asked by them if I wanted to come up, joint venture with them, I said, no, I'm fine. Thank you. I'm doing okay. But I wasn't producing any whiskey. I was just buying aged whiskey out there from our old distillery. So I thought there's really no future in this brand if we don't have anything down the road. So
yeah, because you're going to run out of old whiskey.
Exactly. And some people, when the business improves, they're not going to be able to sell you any more whiskey because they'll need it for themselves.
Right.
Which is the case now. There's not a whole lot of bulk whiskey for sale out there that people can buy. So hooked up with Buffalo Trace, and that's worked out great.
Can you give me three things you wish everybody knew about bourbon? There are only three.
Well, as far as most of them, just the laws of what bourbon is, and Congress 1964 set up laws of what bourbon has to be, because mm-hmm. there's a lot of products out there that, you know, kind of almost bourbon and maybe put bourbon on the label, but they weren't really the exact same thing that they thought they should be. But mainly it has to be made in the U.S., not just Kentucky, any state. We can only use new charred oak barrels. We can only use them one time, so we sell them or cut them in half and put tomatoes in them or something, do something with them after we use them.
Well, other people will put product in used barrels.
You name it. If it's an alcoholic beverage, there's wine, beer, cherry, tequila, you name it.
No
fuel. Rum, yeah. Everybody uses our old barrels. Mostly the Scotch distilleries use them. And I guess, no coloring or flavoring added to bourbon. Bourbon is only made from grain, yeast, and water, and that's it. Nothing else.
It's got to be at least 51% corn to be called bourbon, technically.
Mostly corn, right. Anything above that is, or below that is can't be called bourbon.
And you guys are strictly wheated bourbon, so that other grain is typically wheat.
Wheat, malted barley is the third grain.
And malted barley, as opposed to rye.
Right. Most bourbons use rye as their second grain. Small grain, they call it.
Small grain, yeah. Right.
And we also have a rye whiskey, which is the same as a bourbon, except it's got more rye than corn in the recipe, so you call it straight rye whiskey.
Straight rye. Now, is that the same rule inverted, so it has to be 51% mm-hmm. rye?
Yeah. Same rule, new charred oak barrels. Okay. I'm not sure about, where it can be made as far as in the U.S. or whatever.
And the barrel proof has to be the same. It's all got to be above 80. Does that have to be above 80 proof going into the barrel? I get it confused sometimes.
You can't put it in any higher than 125.
125.
And you can't distill it any higher than 160.
And it can't bottle lower than 80.
Right.
Is that right? Okay.
Right.
I always get those confused.
If it's below 80, it's a light whiskey or something.
A light whiskey.
Or blended.
Do you prefer barrel strength whiskey, or do you always prefer a lower proof?
No, we've got 107 proof, which we call a barrel proof, but it's cut with a little water, but the 125, the 140 proof stuff is, I don't know how you drink that.
That's, well, you mix it with water.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
some people like
that's
it.
That's what
the
branch water's
yeah,
for.
Yeah,
now, people, I can't drink that stuff.
No,
it's too,
your head off. That's what happened to my hair, I guess. Just a little bit too much back in the day.
Yeah, well, back when you got a cold and your parents gave it to you as a tonic.
Exactly.
That's pretty interesting. All right, so that's one thing, the laws.
Mm-hmm.
Got any others? Two more things that you wish everybody knew about bourbon.
It's a long process. Is people say, why don't you just make more? Well, we are, but it's our youngest whiskey's 10 years old, which is older than most distilleries' oldest whiskey. And our oldest is 23. So our business plan is 23 years long. So just realize that we're trying to play catch up right now as far as our brand. And trying to meet the demand and make more whiskey, but it does take time to get there. So we're working on it. And people say, why don't you just sell a 4-year-old whiskey or a 6-year-old whiskey? You get your money that much faster.
Well, it wouldn't be your whiskey, would it?
It would, but I don't like our whiskey when it's that young. And number two, there's too much competition at that level. I'm kind of in a luxurious place where we don't have a whole lot of competition at the 20-year-old bourbon level, so it's a nice place to be.
There's got to be somebody else out there now, though, who's thinking about it.
Oh, I'm sure they all are. I mean, they're popping up all over the place, but it's not our formula. It's not the way we distill it. It's not our distillation proof or entry proof into the barrel and so forth, and not our mash bill. So there's always going to be something a little different. Plus, it's not the equipment we're using. It just doesn't... it's not going to be the same thing. It could be a 20-year-old bourbon or 25-year-old or whatever, but it's not going to be the same as ours. So we have a unique, new, very unique product.
Your recipe is really set up then to age.
Mm-hmm.
Your recipe is meant to be on older
whiskey. Yeah, it's a good thought that the wheated recipe tends to, well, we describe it as it ages more gracefully than a bourbon made with rye. Because we describe it like rye bread and wheat bread. Rye bread is a little bit spicy on the back of your tongue and got a little zing to it,
mm-hmm.
where wheat bread is softer and sweeter. It's the same with bourbon whiskey made with either rye or wheat. Bourbon made with rye is a little spicier, not quite as sweet, and bourbon made with wheat. It doesn't quite pick up as much of the oak and the char in the barrels as a rye recipe does, so it ages longer, a little more gracefully. So, you know, it can stand a little more time in the barrel than a rye bourbon.
Because as a rye evaporates out of the barrel, that's something that I don't think people realize how much whiskey is lost to time.
Yeah.
I mean, people hear the term angel share, but they don't understand that it's the majority the barrel.
Yeah.
When you're talking about a 20-year-old spirit, you could be talking about a loss of, what is it, 5/8 of the barrel, probably?
Yeah, it's when you get 23-year-old whiskey in a barrel, there's probably 7 cases left. And that's it. Versus a 10-year-old, we might get 18. And the older the whiskey, and the level goes down faster and faster each year because more of that oak is exposed, and it dries out and dries out, and so more evaporation, more of it. So it kind of kicks it up. We lose about 10% the first year because it's soaked into the oak, but it's 3-4% each year after that. But it does speed up towards the end of, you know, as it gets above 20 years old, 15 to 20 years old.
What kind of, do you have any idea what percentage you go back up to? I mean, if you go from 10 down to 3-4, what do you go back up to, maybe 8 or 9 again?
It could probably so once it gets past 20, yeah.
Just because you've got so much air in that barrel at that point.
Right. And the staves dry out faster because 20-year-old, we might get 10 cases. Mm-hmm. The 23, we get 6 or 7.
Wow.
So that's a lot of loss. And that's a lot of money up in smoke, so to speak.
Well, I mean, I would put that on the list of things that people just don't realize.
Yeah,
that there right. is, it's that age means a less return as far as the actual amount of product goes,
right.
The concentration of those flavors. So when you're talking about rye not aging as gracefully, you're talking about concentrating kind of those sharp edges,
mm-hmm.
that those spice notes that it already has, right? As opposed to...
Yeah, it just seems to accentuate, the oak barrel just seems to accentuate the rye, the spiciness in the rye as it gets older.
Do you get sick to your stomach when you see somebody put an ice cube in your whiskey?
Not at all.
Don't mind
it
a bit.
On the rocks, yeah.
Do you?
Yeah.
Just wanted to know. Just
mm-hmm.
wanted to know.
I even put a twist of lemon in there too.
Really, lemon?
Just the peel.
In your own whiskey,
mm-hmm.
regardless of the age.
Yeah,
I haven't done that.
It's great. It gives you a nice little citrus pop to the whiskey, which is a nice combination. It's like, I think that's why an old fashioned is so good with bourbon or rye, is that citrus, orangey, citrusy flavor really marries well with bourbon whiskey.
What bourbon cocktails do you like? Do you like a julep? We're sitting here in Louisville, Kentucky.
I can drink one a year. You know, that's fine. They're too sweet for me.
I hate mint juleps. I have to tell you, I just don't like them. I find that all the sugar in the mint gets in the way of the bourbon. I got a hard time with them.
Yeah, but it's interesting. And, you know, 1st of May, it tastes pretty good. But
that's it for the year, huh?
That's it. Just one is all I can do usually. And the other one, of course, is an old fashioned, is my favorite. Made properly. No.
Would you mind sharing a recipe? Do
sure.
You know it on the top of your
sure.
head?
Sure.
Please.
And I learned this from a London bartender friend of ours, Johan Svensson. Take a raw sugar cube or two, put it on top of a napkin, on top of an old fashioned glass that has a slice of orange in it, a thin slice of orange in the bottom of the glass. And you put Angostura bitters on the cube and some orange bitters on the cube. And
wait, the two napkin, or three drops, or
just until it's soaked?
Okay, but saturate the sugar cubes.
Right,
okay.
And the napkin takes the excess because there's nothing worse than too much bitters in a cocktail. But this is a nice way to measure it. So you put the bitters on the cube, and then the napkin soaks up the excess, and you dump those in with the slice of orange, and you get a muddler that my preference is a bar spoon with a little flat disc on the one end of it,
mm-hmm.
so you can. You can muddle the orange and the sugar, but not the rind or the peel. That peel I was talking about has
yes.
pith in it. It's very
yes,
bitter, as you know, and that'll flat ruin a cocktail. But you have a big old, huge wooden muddler.
The end of a baseball bat, basically.
Yeah.
You can't be selective.
And you can't, exactly. You're muddling the whole thing, and that pith will ruin the drink. So you get it. You keep muddling up the fruit and the sugar till it's pretty much dissolved in there, and just kind of build it with some good ice cubes. I'm an ice snob now. Thanks to a few bars in the last few years that really make nice, cold, clear ice cubes.
We can talk ice. We'll talk ice in a minute. I got all kinds
put
of ice
put good
issues.
Ice in
go
there.
Ahead.
And add a little bourbon. 15-year Pappy is our favorite, and I'll tell you why in a second. But just kind of add the ice cubes and the whiskey and keep stirring with the spoon side of the bar spoon. It's a great thing. You can find them on the internet. And just build it up and get the right, it ends up being a good ounce and a half or 2 ounces of bourbon in there, and just stir it up and put a twist of orange in there. A twist, not a slice, and I rub it around the rim. And have you seen bartenders take a peel and flame it into the empty glass?
Sure.
That kind of gives it a little kind of a smoky intensity that, I don't know, I have to get back to you on that one. I'm not sure I like that or not, but it also gives it some, it just really gets that big citrus blast into the glass, which is kind of interesting. But the 107 proof in there, it starts out very intense. For 15 years, 107 proof, which is very high for a drink of whiskey these days. but it starts out being very intense, but as it ice melts, it changes the flavor because it dilutes it. And that's one way to really try whiskeys is we always, at tastings, we tell people to put some in a glass straight, try it, put a drop or two of water in there, and just keep adding some water, and it changes it because it hides the alcohol, brings up more of the wood flavor, more of the grain flavor, and it just flat changes the taste of the whiskey. So as you're drinking this old-fashioned, as it dilutes, it really changes quite a bit. So that's kind of interesting to see how that happens.
But I make big cubes. I'm a big cube guy.
Yeah, that's really one of the best. All you want to do is really chill the drink.
Chill the drink.
And not dilute it.
I want to dilute it too slowly. Yeah, I want to dilute it slowly. And that's the problem with, you know, chipped ice and a lot of ice where you're like, I can't drink that fast. I actually make little water balloons. I fill little bitty balloons with water, which makes kind of this perfect little orb. And then I just break off the balloon, rinse off whatever might have been inside the balloon, and you get these nice kind of egg-shaped ice cubes.
Get all that dust, nice the balloon clear. Dust.
Yeah. Well, I rinse them out, for God's sakes. But that just rinses right off, and then you put that in the glass and go to town.
You can buy, an ice mold.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know.
Little plastic things.
People that are in this industry must turn to you and say, as a demigod, they must look at you and say, my Lord, here, this guy has hit pay dirt by simply not making enough. So you must have people who want you to forecast the future, like a Swami. You know, what's coming? What's going to happen? Where do you see the industry going? Do people ask you these questions?
Yeah, they think, you know, number one, they think we've come upon this great idea to make very little whiskey and pump up the demand in whatever way, and therefore our prices are high. But it just all happened naturally. We have a really good product. We sold it for years, had to go out and sell it. We advertised. We went to shows. Our whiskey, I didn't sell my whiskey. The people that buy it sell it. Word of mouth is the best advertising that you can use anywhere. And that's what happened. But it's no genius marketing deal. It just happened. We had a good product, and it became popular. And just so happens our whiskey is old. So when it became popular, all of a sudden, 20 years, very popular. And 20 years ago, we weren't making enough whiskey.
Right.
So that's what
Why happened. Would you have? You'd have been crazy to.
Right. It's like, exactly. What are you going to do with all that product? You can't sell that.
Who gets the pappy casks? Who gets your barrels?
They go all over. They go Canada, Scotland.
Are they in higher demand because they're yours? Because I haven't heard anybody say, and our scotch is aged in Pappy Van Winkle barrels. Because, I mean, that moves some booze.
It would. I have a friend who put some of his wine in there, Shiraz, in our 20-year-old barrels, and he's got some Grenache coming out pretty soon. It's called Southern Belle. It's Dan Phillips, and he ages wine in our old barrels and for just a few weeks or months, and it's real intense and very interesting. But
if I had one of your barrels, I would cut it into swizzle sticks and sell it to people to swizzle their other bourbon with.
That'd be a good idea.
You're getting a few molecules of Pappy.
That's the way to make your barrel go further than anything.
Absolutely.
Else.
I could probably get 1,000 swizzle sticks out of a barrel. Maybe. Or toothpicks. Oh my God, what was I thinking?
Billions.
Toothpicks.
Billions of
them. Oh my God. I could get, you know, probably 10,000 of those out of a single barrel. You got to think this stuff through, man.
There's somebody out there doing that right now, just because as we speak.
Probably.
But beer, wine, rum, you know, we don't specifically have a place. It's really up to the distillery to where they send the barrels.
Yeah.
We have requests, a lot of requests for mostly beer these days.
Really?
Stouts and porters and all these different, because they want to age them in there 2 or 3 months to give them a little bit of that oaky bourbon-y flavors. Not so much the bourbon that shows through, it's more of the oak.
The oak.
But it's the little bourbon intensity in there.
What if it wasn't fun anymore? What if you got up in 3 months and this stuff was not fun anymore?
I don't have to worry about that.
Oh, what a cop-out. Oh, my God, that's such a cop-out. I can't believe you're going to do that.
It's not going to happen.
You're a young man.
It's not going to happen. All right.
Somebody really needs you now. We're done anyway. Thank you. You go answer your phone, and I'll wrap this thing up.
All right. I'll be right back.
Go ahead.
I do want to say one thing about bourbon.
Say it.
One quick thing.
No, take your time.
One of the law is that it has to be made in the U.S. Can you think of anything in the United States that has to be made here, that is made here only? I can't. Bourbon whiskey is the only thing.
Bourbon whiskey is the official alcoholic beverage of the United States of America.
I haven't come up with anything, so I want somebody to let me know.
I certainly can't think of any other food or beverage.
Right.
No, I can't think of anything else. Who got that? If that is a very, very unique law, how did it come into being, do you think?
I think that the distillers got together and put out these laws of what bourbon has to be because there are too many variables. They were popping up all over the place, and well, that could be bourbon. We have to set the guidelines, so that's probably what happened.
Well, what do you think of the entire bottled and bond thing?
Well,
do you think it still has
now.
A place? Well, no. there's still some whiskeys that are bottled and bond. Right?
Yeah, but that really was just put into place to guarantee that you're getting a pure product, and it was had certain laws. Again, 100 proof had to be 4 years old or 6 years old or whatever it was, and made from one distillery.
During and, one distilling season.
Right, one season. And, the guaranteed label was on the back of the bottle.
And locked up, supposedly in warehouses that some government guy had the keys
to. Exactly. It was just really a way to verify that this product was not made by some farmer down the road.
And you're going to go blind if you drink it. Yeah.
Exactly. So, and that was great for a while. And Bottled and Bond sold. The name Bottled and Bond sold. And my family sold a bunch. My dad, granddad only said, he only sold 100 proof whiskey. And people were coming out with 80 and 86 proof whiskeys, and they said, "Pappy, why don't you sell an 86 proof Old Fitzgerald?" And he said, "Why ship all that water all over the country? I just want 100 proof." So he that was a joke. He's supposed to laugh a little bit about that. It's true.
It's because I'm so deeply wanting to be adopted by him because I completely agree with it. All right, we're gonna go before your phone rings again. But thanks for taking the time.
All right, thanks. Appreciate nice it. To be here. Thanks.
All right, Alton Brown here. We're back from Louisville, Kentucky. I just want to throw out that none of us drank while we were there. I have a guest here up in the studio. I have Joe Gravlich with me. Joe taught me how to fly airplanes and continues to keep me from running them into things. He's also, like myself, something of a bourbon fan. So what we decided to do is we're going to have a little tasting here in the room. Now, we don't have any Pappy Van Winkle to taste because the only bottle that I have of Pappy Van Winkle is it's up here someplace. It's empty, and it's been empty for months. And the way that the waiting list is looking, I'm not going to have another bottle of Pappy Van Winkle until I'm 63 years old. So, but we do have a bottle of what's called Old Rip Van Winkle. It's one of the brands that Julian Van Winkle owns that is easier to find.
It had a plastic top.
It's got a plastic top.
Screw cap.
It's got a screw cap. I mean, it's got a screw cap. It doesn't have a cork, and that's just the way it is. So here's what we've got. I've set up a blind tasting in a traditional laboratory manner, right up to the fact that I'm using mason jars. I have five bourbons here. They are all legal bourbons.
Okay.
So we're talking about at least 51% corn in the mash bill. They've been aged. I believe the minimum age here is 4 years, as is appropriate in American new charred oak barrels. I'm not going to tell you the proofs. I'm not going to tell you what they're made. You've got a spit cup, and we'll just go ahead and throw that away.
Yeah.
No, you're not going to use it. You do have a container of ice here because you might want to, you're going to have to use your fingers, though, because I didn't bring any tongs. And you have some water.
Okay.
And you've got a clean glass for each one of these because I don't want you drinking out of the jar. So here's what I want you to do. Number one, the easy part. I want you to taste all five of these, smell all five of these, and pick out least favorite, most favorite, Old Rip Van Winkle.
Okay. Now, I went through all these and I arranged them first.
All right, by what criteria?
Well, I smelled them all, since you were making me wait so long to taste them.
I was, because I had a hard time getting
I just sat here and I noticed, and this from left to right, the way I'm sitting here, I have them arranged from most pungent to least pungent.
By aroma.
So what strikes me as This one here has a funky smell.
Which number
smell
is it? Go ahead
this
and
is number two.
Okay, number two has got what?
It's kind of a it's almost got a scotch type smell to it.
Some peat, kind of it's the smoky peaty.
There's
kind
some
of thing.
Smoky funky, okay. You know, ness to it. And then
number two.
Down on this end, number four is kind of the least. You know, there's almost no aroma that really bites at your nose there.
And that's so, number what?
Number four.
Okay.
And then it kind of goes up.
Goes
but
up
this
from there.
One definitely is not. This number two is definitely not like the other four. It's definitely there's something different about that one.
Interesting. Okay.
So I'm going to start here at the right and work my way to the left. Which
okay.
Would
so
be,
you're starting with number.
I'm starting with number four. I'm not going to do
okay,
it.
Okay. You're going to have number four
kind of order.
First. And I'm not going to yeah. tell you anything. Now you're drinking this neat for now.
Yeah, for now. That's okay, the way I prefer.
In a compostable corn starch.
I'm
going to
be right out of the mason jars here in a minute.
I thought that was just going too far.
Ooh, number four is nice.
Nice.
Number four, I think I may have had that one before.
Give me something besides nice.
Oh, what do you want?
It's I don't know, make up something. Yeah,
you
know, it tastes
no,
caramel-y.
Definitely not. Well,
with...
this one does have a little bit of a... See, but I don't know what caramel is. You know, it's like what Julian...
Well, it's a candy. You've had a caramel.
Well, yeah, but, you know, when he was talking to us and he was saying that, you know, the people with the palates that can tell, you know, this is a black raspberry, this is chocolate, this is caramel, this is earthy, you know, or smoky. You know, I don't know if I could describe the flavor. That would probably be a talent, you know, to be able to do that. But I know I like that one.
Is it smooth?
It's very smooth. It's very smooth. There's a little bit of spice on the front side of the tongue, and then it finishes very, very nicely.
Spice. So there's a bit of spice
there's,
there. Do you taste much kind of oakiness, kind of like that vanilla flavor that comes out of oak, like it does in wine? Is there any of that? You can have more.
Okay, let me. I mean, I'm going to need a little bit more for it.
Well,
let me have a baseline
okay.
and then compare.
Okay.
I do know I like that one, but yeah, there is.
I'm going to try to keep track of the ones that you like the most.
Okay. Well, that's number four. Let's move on to the next one here. Okay, this one is number one.
Okay,
which
you're now
the aroma,
number one.
This one definitely a little bit more woody. It
more
has
wood.
More, you can pick up more of the oak. It's not as smooth as number four. It definitely grabs at you a little bit more.
Is it burn or is it?
You know, it's got a little more burn. It's got a little more. Yeah, it's definitely more burn because you can feel it on the lips. You know how you get that?
Yeah, sure.
But it's also a little harsher in the flavor. I would like to know when we're done what the grain mix is on this because this is it's almost like there's more of a rye mix
you think?
In this as opposed to if I just had these two to compare, I would say there's probably more wheat in this one because it's that softer
mm-hmm.
type taste compared to this one.
Okay, so you're guessing that number four is weeded and
yeah,
number
one less so.
And number one is probably got rye in it. So
maybe
straight,
I don't know. I only got two to compare, but there's right. definitely a difference here.
Okay, so which number do you have now?
I'm in number five.
All right, you're number
now.
Five. Number five is now up.
Now number five, I'm noticing the color of number five seems to be darker and more fuller than any of the
more
others.
More saturated in color?
It seems to be.
You
number
like
five,
that.
Yeah, that's nice. You don't want to hear nice, do you?
Well, nice is just, doesn't tell me a whole
smooth.
Lot.
Nice, when I say nice, that's smooth.
Okay.
You know, very smooth. But I can tell this one also, you have the warmness, so it probably has a decent proof to it, but it's not like the last one where you
right.
have the burn. There's no burn.
There's no
just,
burn. Any predominant flavors besides it tastes like bourbon? I mean, is there any? Is woody?
No,
is the last one
not as much as the last one? This one, well, the first four was definitely the sweetest. This one you can get some of the spice and the char, but it's not so much as number one.
So it's like the flavor is up there with number one, but smoother.
Yes.
Okay,
that's a good way to.
What about the aroma?
The aroma, it's again, it's. Kind of the most neutral. It has a definite pleasing bourbon type aroma that you'd want to smell. Number four is almost there isn't much of an aroma at all. Number two, which we haven't got to, has that peaty smoky thing going on.
Scotchy, as you said.
Scotch, yeah, it has a scotchy kind of smell to it. Five is kind of pleasantly in the middle. This is a nice balance.
Are you going to change your leader?
No, four are still in the lead.
Okay.
But five has taken over number two.
Okay, so five has taken over number two. Four is still in the lead.
Yeah, number one is still third.
Okay, what number do you have in your hand now? Is this number one?
No, this is number three.
Number three, I'm sorry, number three. Okay, definitely, number three.
Definitely not doing it in the right order.
No, that's fine. I'm keeping track with them because I've got a photograph of
aroma
them with all
the... is about the same as five.
Number three, you smelled it, and you thought that it smelled more like number five. So it was full,
we
robust.
We have a new leader right now.
Okay.
Number three just leapfrogged.
Okay, why?
Four and five.
Quick, while it's on your mind.
Sweeter, smoother, more flavorful, fuller. Fuller. It excites my whole mouth. It
That's valid.
It just hits the whole tongue.
Okay.
You get the wood, but it's not that spicy. It's mellow. The spiciness is mellow, but it's there. You get the woodiness, but it's not overpowering.
So you like this. So three's new. Three's your new winner. Is it way, way ahead? Because you know you're going to have to go back and taste these with ice. Sorry.
No, that's not a problem. Yeah, three's way ahead.
Okay,
three,
way ahead.
Three, five, four, one.
So one's the loser.
So far, but I haven't been to two yet.
Okay. This is very exciting science. I like this.
Me too. Anytime you want to do this.
You know, right now I think it's more important
for me to... If you want to mix the numbers up, we can mix the numbers up.
We can just mix everything together. And you know what we'll do is we'll mix them all together, put
in
a bottle, and put our label
anyway.
On it. And we'll call it something. We'll come up with a cool name, and we'll hand letter the bottle, and we'll sell it for a gajillion dollars.
In a decanter,
and then tell people they can't have any. We're already sold out. In fact, we're not even going to release any this year.
We won't even let us have it.
We won't even let us have it. Sorry, we're already out. That's how exclusive this is. You think Pappy Van Winkle started to get? Okay, this is now number...
This is scotch.
Two.
You gave me scotch.
I did not give you scotch, I swear to God. These are all bourbons. These are all...
This is a
legal
bourbon. I've never had this one before, have I?
That would be tilting this.
It's good. It's different.
So it's smoky or it's peaty?
It's smoky. It's like a scotch that I would enjoy, because you know how scotch tastes really, really good at the beginning, but then you get that aftertaste. Yeah, the smoky, peaty aftertaste. Yeah. I've had a couple scotches where really good on the front and not so smoky on the back, because I like the first sip of scotch. Mm-hmm. It's swallow.
The back of the tongue part.
Yeah,
that
that's the part that I don't care for. This reminds me of that without the backside. I mean, this is a more complex. Ooh, there's a word for you.
This is
definitely more complex, because you drink it and it's sort of like, what's going on here? It's definitely smoky. It doesn't grab at you. But, you know, the smokiness, though, I don't like the aroma. If I could just taste it without smelling it, I think I'd really enjoy it more.
Ah.
It does have, now this does have some spice to it. But it's sweet. It's sweet and spicy. Does that make sense?
Sure, like fruitcake. Or spice cake. Ginger cookie.
Ginger cookie, yeah.
There's some of that
it's
heat,
like
gingery
a,
heat.
It's like a ginger cookie, yeah. Oh, crap. You know what?
So you've got...
I like them all, except number one. So least
like
favorite
one.
Is number one. But here's the thing. This is like...
You've almost got an even horse race. Number one's
like,
way in the back.
This is like your children. You know, if you were to ask me which child do I love more, I don't. You know, I love them all.
Okay,
you know,
but you have to love somebody more.
No, you don't love them more.
Yeah, you love do.
They're different. They all have different talents. They all bring something different
okay,
to the table.
Fine. One of these is going to be the only bourbon you have for the rest of your life. What are the numbers then that are up here? We've got number... Turn towards me.
Number four.
Now, do you want to try some with ice?
Yeah.
Okay. Look, here. Here's your ice. I'm going to let you deal that out. Sorry, that's the best ice that I have. It's filtered, but the cubes are small.
That's the way I like
it. I don't have
it.
Any of the big, nice cubes.
Now, apparently, and I didn't understand this before he explained it, but it makes perfect sense. When he said that...
You only got one cube here. Take another one, so it'll let you.
Thanks. But when you pour it... And it dilutes the alcohol, and it allows the flavor from the barrel to come through.
So he thought that Julian Van Winkle thought the ice was pretty important stuff.
He did.
Yeah.
You know, but he, you know, one ice cube, he said.
He
that's all
that.
You need.
Yeah.
Which.
Of course, we don't know what size ice cube he's talking about, and his drinks could be big. Could be big cubes.
Yeah, but they don't melt very much when you have the big cubes. That's true. Isn't that the case? Slow. Those big spheres, big, I mean, that's slow. Part of the...
Service to mass ratio, yeah. All right, so the one you're tasting now is you're retasting
number four. Four is boring to me now, after the other ones.
So four falls back now again.
Well, wait, we're not done yet, but compared to number two, it's boring. Okay. Because again, that one, very, very... There's a lot going on in number two.
Because you, a while ago... Number four was your favorite.
Well, that was the first one I drank. It was my favorite. Of course it was.
Now, which one are you drinking now?
This is five.
This is five.
Five is not as good as four.
It falls behind. So right now, four is still slightly
out. I gotta still give number one a chance, don't I?
Yeah, you do. I mean, I think that you should give number one a chance. Yeah. I think it's only fair. I mean, it was way behind, you said.
I bet you this is.
I'm not telling.
That's horrible.
It's horrible?
All right, forget about it. That's just going to horrible. That's just flat out going to horrible.
Okay. I love science. This is going to be very good.
Three is still up in the lead there.
Three is in the lead. Four is close behind.
Hang on. Let me go to four. Four.
Is a little bit ahead.
Now, three is in the lead.
Okay,
four is second. Five is third right now.
Yeah, don't go straight to the jar. You can drink out of the jar when we're done.
And this is the only bourbon I can have for the rest of my life, huh?
Well, that's how I want you to think about it. You're evaluating the bourbon you're going to have for the rest of your life, and it's the only one you could have for the rest of your life.
Not this one. This is nice to have every now and then. Number two.
Number two. That was the two one you thought one was scotchy.
It just perplexes me, and I can't wait to find out which one that is. It's very good. I enjoy it, but that's not the one.
That's not the one.
Yeah, that's too sophisticated for me.
So then it's going to come down to four.
Or three. And I think three is a little bit more complex. Three has more flavor. Three, spicy, smooth, flavorful, full, excites the whole tongue. Four... feels a little bit less. It's like maybe it's a lesser proof. Maybe it's watered down a little bit more.
Well, it has now with the ice.
Well, no. I mean, just even if you compare them neat. So these two, I like number three. Number four would be second.
Right,
I don't
now,
know what to do with
favorite.
That one. Yeah.
Because you like that number two.
I like
you just
it,
don't know what
but
to do
it, but it's, all right. It's like a special occasion. I need to be in the right frame of mind for it. That's not an everyday.
Okay.
This one I'm disappointed in.
Okay, number one. Sorry.
Okay.
So now, your favorite
three
is number three.
Yes.
And we'll get to what that is. Your least favorite
number one.
Mm-hmm. Which one is the old Rip Van Winkle?
No.
Now you can drink straight from the mason jar if you want because your cups are all diluted.
You know what? You know which one I think is because I had the old Rip and...
Not on the plane, mind you, but...
Not on the plane.
When we got down on the ground, we
but
did.
When we landed, but, however, I had the old Rip with the lemon twist in it.
That's
which,
true.
Which, by the way, was very good. Which I think would have taken some of the out of it. See, I would have to guess, because I don't know...
Okay.
I don't know what you gave me, but based on knowing that old Rip was 107 proof and it was a little bit harsh, I'd say it's number one.
Number one is Elijah Craig 20.
You're kidding me.
No. That's the most expensive bourbon on the table.
You've got to be kidding me.
Number one is Elijah Craig 20, which you are very right. It is not a weeded bourbon. That's a, I'm 99% sure that's a rye bourbon. And I would have said one of the best bourbons I'd had in my house. I'm feeling bad now. I didn't open the best one in the house. We're going to say that for another time.
Wow.
I didn't open that one. All right. So, that's
and
not.
Number three, I bet was Jack Daniels, wasn't it?
I want you to keep guessing which one the Pappy is. The old Rip. And I'm going to have to stop you because then we're going to have to go over what was your favorite and what was your not favorite. So if you got to make a guess from what's remaining, one of them is indeed the old Rip Van Winkle.
Oh, wow.
I know. I've thrown you for one.
You've thrown me for one because I've had the Elijah Craig and I loved it. When it was standalone,
yeah, I know.
I loved it.
Mind blown. So what do you think? You've got four left. Now you're drinking it to try to get it to convince well, now, you. Now you're like, oh, well, yeah, now that I've been, no.
See, but there is a lot to that, isn't there?
But you completely didn't like it.
Compared to the others. But like I said, it's like your children. I still like it. It's just
you like all bourbon.
This is just the child that
is
doesn't play baseball. I guess. I mean, I don't know. All right.
Yeah,
that's not number two is not Old Rip. I don't want to say number three since that is the one that I'm enjoying the most. I don't want to say that is. I would say it's going to be either five or four. And now I feel totally lost. I'm going to say five.
You are correct. You are correct.
Okay.
Now, I think that it may have been a little easier for you because it's the only 107 proof on the table. Everything else on the table is 90 because okay. I didn't have another 107 proof to pour you.
See, but that the Craig, I thought, was the 107 proof. No. But that it's not a weeded bourbon, though, is it?
I'm pretty sure it is not a weeded bourbon. Okay. I'll have to go check. So, but it's not a weeded bourbon. But we know, but the Rip is. And number four is the Weller.
Really?
So it's you're good at this because you put very close together. They're very, very close. May even be the same distillate. We're not sure that it isn't. But those are the weeded bourbons.
Those two smell very much the same. That I thought they were the same.
Okay.
One.
That's, number two.
Number two. That has to be the Willet.
It is not. I didn't open the Willet. I didn't open the Willet.
Sure.
Hudson Baby Bourbon.
Okay.
New York, baby.
That would make sense.
Which you have had before.
I have had it.
And your number one favorite? Pepper 1776.
Yeah, baby.
Pepper 1776 is a 15-year bourbon. Neither you or I had ever seen it before a few months ago.
No, and I love it. I had it last night. It's
a pretty good stuff. That is a product of Kentucky. And the winner hands down. So
well, this makes me feel good though because I can go out and buy the Weller because I bought that Weller. Which one was Weller? Four or five?
Four. Four okay. is the Weller,
and that was the one that I said was my second favorite.
Yeah, and that was $27 or something.
$24.
And $24.
But it was the Weller 12-year.
Okay.
Okay, because the they had a Weller 107 proof, which didn't have an age, which I bet would be real close to the Old Rip.
Well, the Old Rip is
10-year 107 proof.
10-year 107, yeah.
So the Weller, that's good to know, let me tell you, because if you don't want to spend $115 on the 1776, although I would highly recommend it because
highly recommend it.
The Weller Weller 12-year.
12-year.
Yeah.
Kentucky straight.
Yeah.
Weeded.
Yes.
So that... For $24,
yes,
we'll drink.
That's
that
the power buy. Absolutely, long. I'm gonna make sure I have that in the cabinet.
So you have that, and you have the Pepper 1776 at $150 a bottle.
For it's
$114 for special occasions. All right, smell now it. I finally get to have a sip of something here. See, that was number. Hold on, I make sure I got
that. Was number two.
Yeah, it is number two.
Yeah,
I get the scotchiness.
Mm-hmm.
There's definite peat. It reminds me a little of Laphroaig. Or an Isla Scotch. And you know what? You could have sold that to me as Scotch and I would have believed
it. See, I told you.
It makes me wonder if somebody didn't sneak Scotch into my bottle. No, I know I didn't because I opened the bottle.
Which one do you want next?
I want...
Craig.
I want that last.
Okay.
You know what I want? I want the Weller.
The Weller is four, right?
Turpentine-y. I get paint thinner. I mean, I don't mean that in a bad way.
That's not
but
that
I get,
strong, though.
No, but I'm getting...
But here, smell it compared to that one. That one's stronger.
Candy. Butterscotch.
You're kidding me.
Butterscotch. I get butterscotch out of
that's
one.
Turpentine. That's just because you know what this is.
No. Smell them side by side. It smells like a piece of butterscotch.
All right. That is sweeter. All right. You're right.
I get astringent acetone, something that's some kind of like a cleaning product out of number four. Well, I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean,
the pilot likes the cleaning products.
Well, it's just like,
give him the $24 bottle. He's a cheap date.
A good Riesling's got kind of diesel fume.
Yeah, diesel. Yeah.
But it's not strong. The aroma is not strong. So this is the Weller. Four is Weller. Five
try that.
Is Old Rip.
That's Rip. Try that compared to that because they're very, very. Oof,
I don't like this when I smell it.
Really?
I don't like that.
Interesting.
I don't like number five. I'm sorry. It's hot to me and it's whiskey.
It is. That's 107.
Maybe that's what I'm responding to. Maybe I'm responding to that. But 90 and 107 aren't that different.
Oh.
Four is better than that. Okay, now I want to taste the pepper. That is number three. I like it. It's a little boring on the back end. Just a hair. Ooh, but it's got a nice burn. Mm-hmm. Ooh, that's nice for a night. Mm-hmm.
No, it is at night. It's very relaxing.
All right, I would drink that all day long. All right, now give me that Craig 20 that I've been bragging about. Candy, not taffy. Taffy, not caramel. Saltwater taffy.
Which one was that again?
It's the Elijah Craig.
Right there, right?
That's all nasty, dirty, skunky on the back end. Golly. I got hosed.
But no, but we liked it the other day.
I know, when we weren't drinking it with other stuff.
So it's either Pepper or Weller. I mean, that's really... this is the Weller, right? Four?
Four is the Weller, yes. At $24 a bottle. Let's get
12-year. And 12-year. But it has to be the 12-year. There's a whole bunch of them in there. And actually, I'm not even sure if that would really make a difference. The pepper,
pepper's
I like.
Pretty sweet.
I like the pepper.
It's sweet.
I like the pepper.
I'm stunned. I'm stunned that that both of us would have easily mistaken the Hudson Baby Bourbon for scotch.
Yeah.
Even as I smell it right now, I got absolutely no issue with that.
There's something.
I mean, it's good, but it's scotchy.
And by itself. But it's not. When you said, "What if you can only have one, and this is going to be the bourbon you drink all the time," that wouldn't be it.
I'm with you. The Weller is the power buy.
It's a value.
$24 for a 12-year-old bourbon.
Yeah, you can't beat that.
Well, what you got to do is I don't think the pepper is weeded. We're going to go on the old Weber netter here real quick. It is a high rye recipe. It's got a bunch of rye in it,
which is surprising.
So what it means in the end is that we like rye bourbons with rye in them more than we like bourbons without rye in them.
But the Weller's is weeded.
So we're going to choose the Peppers as a high rye version that's expensive, and then we're going to choose the Weller as the power by weeded bourbon.
Yeah, until you bring me more. Bring me five more and we'll do it again.
That's all the time that we've got today on the podcast. I'm going to figure out how to get Joe home. Tune in next time where we'll have a more exciting tasting of something. And in the meantime, America, remember, cook smart.